Well, let's jump right into this exploration into the source material. So imagine you're walking into a 14th century church in Iberia.
Right, setting the scene.
Yeah, and you realize the person sitting right next to you in the pew isn't just your neighbor. They're like a potential theological spy.
Which is wild to think about.
Exactly. I mean, we usually hear about medieval Spain as this peaceful melting pot where everyone just kind of got along, you know?
Right, the whole Convivencia myth.
Yeah, but the texts we're looking at today, specifically around these polemical encounters, they paint a much more intense picture. It wasn't a melting pot at all.
No, definitely not. It was more like a pressure cooker of verbal warfare. Because these weren't just dusty academic debates happening in a vacuum.
They were really high stakes, right?
Exactly. High
Yeah.
stakes rhetorical battles. And the goal wasn't really to understand the other person. It was about using language as a literal weapon.
And the craziest part to me is that the sources show we are actually the target.
Right. You, the reader or the listener, you're the primary target. The authors were writing to force you to take a stand in a world that felt, well, increasingly unstable.
So it's not a conversation at all, it's an attack. But the word polemic didn't actually exist back then, did it?
No, it didn't. Yet this practice of aggressive writing was literally everywhere.
Yeah.
It acted like a mirror,
A
essentially.
mirror. Like, if I'm writing a scathing takedown of your beliefs, I'm not actually talking to you.
You're really talking to yourself, or I
Yeah.
guess to your own community.
Oh, okay. Is that kind of like a sports rivalry where, hating the other team is the only thing that actually makes your own fans feel united?
That's a great way to put it, yeah. It's like deep cover espionage mixed with that sports rivalry. When a writer attacks the other, they are erecting a boundary.
To define who we are.
Precisely. By defining you as the infidel or the heretic, the writer is desperately trying to solidify their own group's identity.
Right.
You're pointing out how crooked the other side is, just to make sure your own mask is straight.
Wow, that sounds like a massive amount of effort just to feel secure. And this need for self-definition led directly to what the texts call weaponized philology, right?
Yes, weaponized philology.
Which, for those who aren't linguists, philology is basically the forensic study of language and history and texts.
Right.
But these scholars weren't just reading for fun.
Not at all. They were performing linguistic autopsies on their rivals' holy books. They were actively looking for glitches.
Like what, for example?
Well, in the 13th century, you had Dominican friars like Ramon Martí, who mastered Hebrew and Arabic, but not out of tolerance or respect.
Right, they were looking for ammunition.
Exactly. Finding internal, authentic contradictions in the Torah or the Quran.
Wow.
Yeah, Martí would take a specific prophecy from the Torah, use his mastery of Hebrew grammar, and argue that logically it could only be fulfilled by Jesus.
So it's a linguistic checkmate using their own sacred history against them. But wait, isn't there a massive risk there?
What do you mean?
Well, if you spend all day, every day, reading your enemy's holy book, don't you accidentally start seeing their point of view, like some sort of intellectual Stockholm syndrome?
Oh, that risk was incredibly real. And that deep study, combined with the dream of converting people, led to a very messy reality in the 14th century.
The conversos, right.
Yes. So after the violent pogroms of 1391, thousands of Jews were forced to convert to Christianity. These were the conversos.
So suddenly the other isn't outside the city gates anymore. They're sitting at your family dinner table.
Exactly. This internal blurring caused widespread panic. You have figures like Vincent Ferrer making these really radical claims.
What'd he say?
He argued that a Christian who lives next to a Jew will never be a good Christian. The influence is just considered too strong.
So the boundary's completely dissolved, which I guess ironically made the arguments even more vicious because now the enemy is basically invisible.
Yes, and that is exactly why the focus shifted to a new symbol of authority, the captive.
Oh, right. Because you can't trust your neighbor anymore.
Right, you have to look for someone with authentic knowledge of the enemy. Someone who had been a prisoner, like Ramon Lull, who had literally lived in the shadows of the other side.
Being a prisoner gave you, like, a badge of authority.
You could claim to speak the truth because you had the literal scars to prove you'd been in the outside world.
So the prisoner becomes the ultimate insider outsider. They're the only ones pure enough to tell you what the enemy is really thinking.
Because they lived it without being corrupted by it, supposedly.
It just shows that these ancient arguments weren't just audio textbooks or dry theories. They were social practices, real survival strategies with sometimes violent consequences.
They really were. It reminds us that identity is so often forged in the heat of conflict rather than in the peace of agreement.
Absolutely. Well, to wrap up our exploration today, here is a provocative thought for you to carry away. The source material mentions that the Sephardi philosopher Baruch Spinoza grew up in the shadow of these very same Iberian polemical traditions.
Which is fascinating context for his work.
Right, because his radical criticism of divine scripture essentially paved the way for the Enlightenment.
Right.
So consider this, what happens to a religion when its own tools of defense are turned against the concept of revelation itself?
When the weaponized language is turned on the people who built it.
Exactly. A very profound question to end on. Definitely something to mull over.